I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance. Today, Thursday, February 24, 2005. Clerk, take the roll, please.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison. Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Messwell. Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Bodestrom.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so we'll take a look at the minutes from the previous meeting, February 23, 2005. They're in the packet. Representative Cornish moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The bill that we have before us today is House File 572, Representative Johnson, Methamphetamine Enforcement Act. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe before I start, I will move House File 572 to be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. And then I also have a technical amendment. I'd like to move the 572A2 amendment.
All right. The bill is before us. And Representative Johnson, restate your motion on that technical amendment.
The H0572A2 amendment, I'd like to move that. To
put all right, Representative Johnson has moved the A2 amendment as an offers amendment. Any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That motion prevails. The bill is amended now as before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I start, I want to recognize a Burnsville High School, I think it's a senior or several senior government students here. They're kind of filling up the room, and they came over today and were following a bill, and it just happened to be mine, and we happen to have our first hearing today. So I want to welcome you all. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk to you this morning, but I'm glad you're here. I want to walk through the bill very briefly, and I'm not going to give a long stirring speech on methamphetamine, because you're going to hear from several different people after I'm done walking through the bill this morning who are much closer to the issue and probably can give more personal testimony on what this horrible drug is doing to Minnesota. But I do want to say one thing before I tell you what's in the bill. I represent suburban Minnesota, and a lot of us like to recognize meth as a rural problem, and it certainly is. It's more than just a rural problem. It's a devastating rural Minnesota. But I can tell you also that it is here. It's in St. Paul. It's in Minneapolis. It's in the suburbs. It's in the exurbs. It might not be as visible as it is in rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota, but I would guess if we don't do something dramatic immediately in 6 months or a year, it will be devastating my district just as it's devastating Representative Eastland or Representative Soderstrom's district. I have talked to a lot of the kids at my schools, especially senior high students at my schools out in the western suburbs, and they are using meth. They don't seem to understand the risks to it yet, but it's a very attractive drug for high school kids. It helps you to stay up late at night and has some other what they consider positive side effects, but the problem is it's probably more addictive than any drug we've ever seen before. It takes over your brain and your nervous system and eventually your soul, and it destroys your life in an instant. And I don't know how many of you remember Jim and Lene Clark, who were here a couple weeks ago. They were former meth addicts or meth addicts that were recovering. And one of her statements was that she saw meth as one of Satan's most powerful tools in the destruction of God's children. And the more I learn about this truly frightening drug, the more true that statement rings to me. Some will argue that this bill is too drastic. I disagree. It's certainly not. However, even if it is, this is a very drastic problem, and I think it deserves a drastic solution. So with that, Mr. Chair, let me walk through the bill, and I will pay particular attention to the criminal provisions in the bill. First of all, on page 2, starting on line 2, there is a provision that adds methamphetamine to the definition of a narcotic drug in existing statute. And essentially what that does, it provides law enforcement another crime with which to charge meth defendants. Currently, the sale and possession of meth are expressly addressed in first and second degree controlled substance offenses as long as you have a certain minimum amount of the drug. Third degree sale, however, does not mention meth, but it does forbid the sale of a narcotic drug. So by adding methamphetamine to that definition, a prosecutor would now be able to charge a person who sells a small amount of meth with a third-degree drug offense as opposed to a fourth degree. Next, starting on line 22 on page 2, is what is referred to as Schedule 5. That is the restrictions on the precursor drugs, on the pseudoephedrine and ephedrine drugs. That's the piece of the bill that the media has probably focused on most, and it's probably the most controversial portion of the bill. Because there is some criminal provisions in here, I will give you at least in a nutshell what it says. First of all, any products that contain pseudoephedrine or ephedrine as an active ingredient can only be sold by a pharmacist or a pharmacy technician. An individual can only buy 2 packages of up to 6 grams at a time, and a person can only buy 6 grams over a 30-day period. And 6 grams of a pseudoephedrine product is ballpark 7 or 8 pseudoephed boxes, essentially. So over a 30-day period, one person could not buy more than that. You have to be 18 to purchase precursor drugs. You must show a photo ID to prove that, and you need to sign a log. And a person who knowingly violates any of these provisions, and usually it is set forth as the sale in violation of one of these provisions, can be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 90 days and payment of a $1,000 fine or both. There's also a provision starting on line 27 of page 4 that says that an owner, operator, supervisor, or manager of a business in which an employee has been convicted of violating this law is not subject to criminal penalties if they didn't know about it and there is some sort of employee training program in place. There is a provision on page 5 that says anyone who sells a precursor drug in a suspicious transaction, which is defined on the previous page, shall report that suspicious transaction to a manager who may report the suspicious transaction to the police. And there's an immunity provision in there that says a person who reports such a suspicious transaction in good faith is immune from civil liability relating to that report. The restrictions in this provision on sale of precursors do not apply to pediatric products or children's products. They don't apply to anything in liquid form. They don't apply to gel caps. They don't apply to any precursor drug that's certified by the Board of Pharmacy in a manner that prevents the drug from being used to manufacture meth, and there's a requirement that along with the Department of Public Safety, they make a list. And it doesn't preclude someone from buying any cold product that does not have pseudoephedrine or ephedrine as an active ingredient. So it is a significant restriction, but it's far from a complete restriction. There are many options that are still available. A criminal provision on page 5, starting on line 28, is the provision with respect to intent to manufacture meth. This really hasn't changed all that much. The old language, as you see on line 36, said a person is guilty of attempted manufacture if the person possesses a precursor with the intent to manufacture meth. All we have done, we haven't changed the crime, we've just changed what is kind of the title of the crime, and we've taken out the words attempted manufacture because it's confusing. There is no need to attempt in order to violate that law. You simply have to have an intent. So the crime is still the same, it's just not called an attempt crime anymore. There is also a list of potential precursors, and we've added language that says this is not all-inclusive because we learn of new ways to make meth frequently. The penalty on page 7, starting on line 2, someone who violates this intent crime can be sentenced to 10 years and or $20,000. That used to be 3 years and $5,000. And if the conviction is a subsequent controlled substance conviction, the penalty is 15 years and or $30,000. That used to be 4 and $5,000. I should point out right at the beginning here, there are no mandatory minimum sentences in this bill as there were last year. There's some clarifying language below that on page 7 that just incorporates the language on Schedule 5. And then you turn to page 8. Starting on line 7, there is a restitution provision. And it requires a court to require a person who has been convicted of some sort of meth crime to pay restitution to all public entities that participated in any sort of emergency response to secure the site or remediate the site or clean up the site. There's also a provision on page 9, starting on line 3, that requires that same person to provide restitution to a property owner who incurs removal or remediation costs there is an exception if the convicted person is indigent or payment would create an undue hardship for the convicted person's immediate family, which my guess is probably going to be most cases. But at least in those few cases where someone can afford to pay restitution, they will not have to. Starting on line 14, there are some provisions requiring filing of notices when a piece of property has been contaminated by a meth lab. I'm not going to go through all of them unless someone asks me to, but I do want to point out on page 11 as part of this, line 6, there is a criminal penalty. Before any transfer of ownership of any property that the owner knew or should have known had been used as a clandestine lab site and contaminated by meth, go down to line 14, the owner shall record with the county recorder or registrar of titles of the county in which the property is located an affidavit containing information regarding that, and any person who violates this paragraph is guilty of a petty misdemeanor. Next page, page 12, line 34, there is a recodification essentially of existing anhydrous ammonia language. We've added a couple things to it. In essence, if you go to line 5 on page 13, it is illegal to steal anhydrous ammonia. It's illegal to purchase or possess anhydrous ammonia knowing that it's going to be unlawfully used to manufacture a controlled substance. It's illegal to place anhydrous ammonia in a container not designed for anhydrous ammonia or transport it in a container not designed for that. And number 5, it's illegal to use, deliver, receive, sell, or transport a container without the consent of the owner. And finally, it's illegal to tamper with any equipment or facility used to contain, store, or transport anhydrous ammonia.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, sorry for breaking in. I do have a question on this specific point, so I'd like to ask if it's all right.
I think what members, I think you'll have to bear with me on some of the decisions I'm going to have to make here, but I'd like you to hold your question as my response for these reasons. One, this is an important bill, and we simply don't have time to digest everything we're going to hear today. We do have the luxury of seeing this bill at another date later in March after it's gone through about 5 other committees. So we will then have an opportunity to see what they do. Secondly, we have a number of testifiers that we want to hear from. Third, we have a number of amendments that are important. And frankly, I want to schedule time beginning next week to hear testimony on those amendments so that anyone in the audience, any group who's represented by a lobbyist will also have time to prepare for testimony on the amendments. Representative Tamar has some, Representative Soderstrom has some. Those are the amendments to date. So what I'd like members to do is we will go to the author right after he's done for question and answer, but it's going to be brief. So when you think of questions today, please write them down. They will be answered. We just may not get them to them today. Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to point out on this anhydrous ammonia provision, numbers 1 and 2 on line 6 and 8 are new. Those are new criminal actions. 3, 4, 5, and 6 were already in the law. There is an immunity provision on line 28 that if you illegally tamper with someone else's anhydrous ammonia, you can't sue them if you get hurt. That is currently in the law. It's just being moved. And then finally, on page 14, line 6, the criminal penalty for violation of any of these anhydrous ammonia provisions is up to 5 years and or $50,000. That is also currently in the law. That is not new. Line 12, page 14, methamphetamine-related crimes involving children and vulnerable adults. That is a new crime. And if you go down to line 32, that states what the crime is. I will read it. No person may knowingly engage in any of the following activities in the presence of a child or vulnerable adult, in the residence of a child or vulnerable adult, in a building structure conveyance.
Excuse me, Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us page and line number?
I'm sorry. Page 14, line 32. I'm actually on line 35 now. In a building, structure, conveyance, or outdoor location where a child or vulnerable adult might reasonably be expected to be present, in a room offered to the public for overnight accommodation or in any multiple-unit residential building, obviously very broad. The 4 things you cannot do, you can't manufacture or attempt to manufacture meth. You can't store any chemical substance, and chemical substance is defined on line 16 of page 14 as a substance intended to be used as a precursor to meth. There's an intent requirement there. You can't store meth waste products or store meth paraphernalia. Also, on line 9, page 15, no person may knowingly cause or permit a child or vulnerable adult to inhale, be exposed to, have contact with, or ingest meth, a chemical substance, or meth paraphernalia. The criminal penalty on line 13, up to 5 years and or $10,000. Page 15, line 22, a police officer may take a child present in a place described above into protective custody and must offer a health screening for that child. Page 15, line 34, there is a provision for reporting maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. It requires a police officer to report vulnerable adults exposed to meth or to a meth lab. Starting on line 9 of page 16, it instructs county entry point staff and county social service agency staff on how to respond to such a report. On page 17, line 16, it requires notification of on a vehicle's title if it's been contaminated by methamphetamine. Line 25 of that same page, it requires law enforcement to notify the chief administrator of a school when a student has been placed in protective custody after being exposed to a meth lab. And on page 18, the last substantive provision starts on line 6. That's the Meth Laboratory Cleanup Revolving Loan Fund. And essentially it provides loans to counties and cities for cleanup purposes. It's rather technical, and I'm praying that no one wants me to go through it, but I will if anyone asks me to. And if you move to page 21, there are some revisor's instructions on line 6. Line 18, there's a repealer of the old anhydrous ammonia language that has just been moved. And then there are the appropriations, which have not been filled in yet, but they will track the governor's budget proposal on this. And I will tell you right now, we ordered a fiscal note, but unfortunately we ordered it under House File 4, which was my first bill, which was quite different from this. So I will have a fiscal note when I come back to public safety.
And that was another reason, Representative Ellison, if we will see the bill again, because to simply put, the fiscal note is to a different bill and it will have to be corrected. I think at this time I'd like to, you have a roughly a 10-minute video you'd like to run, and then we'll get right into testimony.
The big news of the day, 2 minutes away now, but first, it's America's fastest growing drug. Methamphetamine, accounting for one of every five federal drug arrests, meth is also one of the fastest growing problems for police. But cops and lawmakers are saying they've come up with a few ways to try to stop it from spreading.
Aaron
in a
Bell.
Pop report now from Steve Brown.
From babies born addicted to methamphetamine to teenagers who die using meth to the spread of meth-related crimes, there is a steep price for America's growing meth use. Nationally, meth arrests are up, and the number of meth users sent to prison is up, too.
It's dangerous, isn't it?
Very dangerous. Very.
I take it you didn't care.
No, not at all. I was out there getting high. All I cared about was getting high.
In the Minnesota prison system alone, the number of meth inmates has gone up fivefold in 4 years. Once behind bars, some get drug treatment, which costs money. So does fixing meth mouth, the term for the rotting teeth of meth users.
Yeah, I know it was making my teeth go hell, but I didn't really care, I guess, because I was, you know, wanted to be high instead.
The methamphetamine problem is costing Minnesota taxpayers somewhere between $170 and $190 million a year.
And meth is a problem almost everywhere, and it's why more than 20 states may copy Oklahoma. Last year, Oklahoma lawmakers clamped down on cold medicines containing pseudoephedrine. It's the critical ingredient in making meth, and it's needed in bulk. Oklahoma moved all pseudoephedrine remedies behind the pharmacist's counter. Quantities are limited. Buying it requires a photo ID and a signature. Result, meth lab busts are down in Oklahoma a startling 80%.
This has worked in Oklahoma, Steve. The problem is that they've gone over the border into Missouri and places like that.
That do not have Oklahoma's pseudoephedrine restrictions. But two U.S. senators, Republican Jim Talent of Missouri and California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, are proposing a new federal law which would make Oklahoma's restrictions on pseudoephedrine medications the law of the land. and hoping to keep the costs of America's meth mess from spiraling higher.
Tonight, the iTunes Bench Ratio shows us how Minnesota's war on meth is now being fought at a store near you.
Welcome. Please scan your first item.
Cold medicine isn't something most of us get real excited about. Not so for David Osborne.
When I saw it rolling through the center, and I thought we're gonna have a party.
You need a little help. Pseudoephedrine is the key ingredient in...
Representative Johnson, unless we can get a volume up, I would suggest we cut this off and then review it next week.
...was caught David buying a basket full of boxes. Store security figured he was using it for...
We'll include that in next week's beginning hearing for our amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that.
Wait, that's fine. We'll wait till the lights are on and then...
As long as it doesn't mess up the power. Why don't you leave it for now? That's all right. Maybe during a break we can try it next time. Go ahead. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I apologize for the video. It's one of those technological things that worked fine a half an hour ago.
That's show business. Stuff happens. We will reschedule you to come back next week when we begin hearings on the amendments. I think it's worth seeing, and we'll just put it off for another time. So go ahead.
It should work now.
can you give us another hour at noon?
You want me to rewind it or not?
No, we'll reschedule.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I certainly agree with your comments, Mr. Chair. This is a very serious problem, and I agree with Representative Johnson's comments that it's a drastic problem that requires action. Representative Johnson asked me to come here and just give a 10-minute or so overview on meth, talk a little bit about where we've been in Minnesota, where we're at now, and what could or likely will lie ahead for us. I know that many members of the committee have heard testimony over the years about methamphetamine, so I won't go into great detail in the first few slides, but I do want to tell you a few things. I'm not going to talk about a lot of individual cases. Some of the other testifiers may do that, but I wanted more set the stage and give you that broader overview. And I'll do this one other time. Here's some before and after photos of meth addicts and the devastating effect it can have on individuals. Just a quick reminder of some of the key factors. Children are found in about half of the labs here in Minnesota. This is not atypical for a meth lab. These are the kinds of environments that children are living in regularly in Minnesota if their parents or others in the home are manufacturing meth. Weapons are often found at meth labs for good reason. This is a very dangerous profession to be in. If you're going to manufacture meth, if you're going to deal meth, if you're going to be a meth addict. Not only is one of the characteristics of someone addicted to methamphetamine is to become paranoid, so they're watching for law enforcement, and they're not trusting their friends and their family. The truth is we are after. And there are people, I'll talk in a minute about some of the violence that is associated with methamphetamine. There are robberies, there are sexual assaults, there are tortures, quite frankly, there are beatings between dealers and customers and between informants and drug dealers. So it actually makes some sense that they would be concerned for their safety. Meth is the meth aside. Forget about the meth itself. Just the production of it is a very dangerous enterprise. Things blow up. People get burned. People die. People get injured. The environment gets affected. Here's another meth lab that there was a problem at. Obviously, the toxic waste in the bathtub there is not being disposed of properly. I can guarantee you that. This is the kind of thing that, these aren't the best and brightest in Minnesota that are manufacturing this. They're not taking care of the things. There's part of the bill talks about motels or where people come and stay on short term. I guarantee you it may not happen to me and it may not happen to you or your children, but some parent is going to check into a motel in Minnesota and they're going to be staying in a room where there's a meth lab the day before and their kid is going to lay on the carpet or they're going to lay on the bedspread where there were some spills. And again, the odds of it happening to me or you is minimal. The odds of it happening to some parent in Minnesota is extremely high. This is going on in motels. It's going on where totally innocent people are being affected by this. 4 years ago, I appeared before this committee and testified about methamphetamine. This is one of the slides I used then. I would just point out a couple things, let it kind of soak in for a second. But Iowa, If you look at where they were in 95 and where we were, fairly close tracking in terms of the number of meth labs. You look at Missouri, where they used to be, and where they've gone now, or by the year 2000 when I was here 4 years ago. You can see the climb. Again, Iowa is very similar situated to us. They've seen an astronomical climb. We've climbed, and I'll show that here in a second, but not quite at the same rate. The one point I want to make here is that you look back 6-7 years ago, 95, 96, 97, in that range, we are now where Iowa and Missouri used to be. Okay, those are the kinds of, somewhere under 500 labs, 400 or 500 labs, and that range is where we sit today. Here's what's happened since 2000. Give you a feel for where we're at with the number of labs. It's a conservative number because these are the number of labs actually reported to DEA through the EPIC system, so it's 100%. And we know every one of these is there. There are additional labs that have been found in Minnesota by law enforcement. One reason why it's reported through EPIC, first, we just encourage it so we'd have accurate numbers. But secondly, it's more likely they can get federal funding for cleanup. But there are some smaller labs that have been dealt with separate from these numbers, so this is a conservative number. The impact of methamphetamine just across some of our public entities, some of the agencies that we all deal with. Meth treatment emissions from human services, you can see that's up almost 300% in the past 4 years. The number of filings in adult court, not juvenile court, but in adult court, that deal strictly with meth is up that high in the last 4 or 5 years. Prison population, I know you're familiar with that, with the effect that meth has had on that. And then the last two are the drug task forces. There are 22 of them in Minnesota. These reflect the arrests made for, again, purely meth cases and then meth labs seized. Where does the money come from to deal with the meth problem? It comes from these public entities. This, as the commissioner said, and you'll hear, I think, in next week when we see the video, it will cost Minnesota, it did cost Minnesota taxpayers $176,000 conservatively last year in 2004 to deal with meth. The projected cost, if some of the labs go down as we're hoping, some of those things happen, we're still projecting a cost of about $130 million a year ongoing. Here's the percentages breakdown of where that's coming from. We have a fairly detailed study that I'm sure we could share with you if you wanted the backdrop of this, the calculations. Two important things about this slide to keep in mind. One, it doesn't have anything to do with the juvenile criminal justice system. This is none of the juvenile stuff. This is only adults. And secondly, none of the related crimes, none of the assaults, none of the sexual assaults, none of the burglaries, identity thefts, homicides, all those things are not included in this. These are purely methamphetamine cases, drug cases, not what some people do when they're under the influence of meth. Just an example of the cost. For law enforcement, there's a high cost. It's the cost of training. It's the cost of the equipment. It's the cost of the supplies. These sites are not safe to go in and out of unless you're properly trained and properly equipped. We have 120 or so law enforcement officers around the state now trained to do this, OSHA certified. Every lab takes a lot of law enforcement resources. In fact, you'll hear from a minute. You're hearing a minute from an Anoka County sergeant who's here to testify because Steve Schultz, the sheriff in Kanawha County, got called at 3 a.m. this morning and went out in a meth lab. He has 7 deputies in his county. If he doesn't go, nobody does. So he won't be here today to testify. Lab submissions, just to drive the point home a little bit of what's happened at the BCA. This is clearly a staffing issue for us, a cost for us. Those are the number of items that have been submitted to our lab that are methamphetamine in the past 4 or 5 years. You can see the spike the last 3 years. Here's a closer look at Iowa and Missouri and Oklahoma, just real quickly. You can see where in particular, Missouri's gone. You can see Iowa, the steady climb. Again, we are now where they were in about 99 here. We're under 500 conservatively. We're probably right around that number now. And you can see what's happened in some of the nearby states. You'll notice that Oklahoma did go down. There's a reason for that, and I'll talk about it in more detail, but this may be foreshadowing. Either we're going to follow the other two or maybe Oklahoma. Part of the reason for Oklahoma's decline in the last year is that, as the video talked a little bit about, they passed a law that restricted pseudoephedrine. If pseudoephedrine is not available, there cannot be a meth lab, period. It is an essential ingredient to making meth in Minnesota. Without pseudoephedrine, there cannot be a lab. Other states have tried restrictions, and they have failed. Missouri has failed. They had, in 2001, put a restriction in, a law that said you can only purchase 9 grams or 3 packages at a time. They had about 2,100 labs that year. The next year it went up 29% with that law in place. The following year, they tightened it up more to say 6 grams or have it behind a counter or maybe within 10 feet or plain view of the counter so that the clerk could keep a close eye on any ingredient or any medication that has pseudoephedrine in them. Again, they went up another 9%. It doesn't work. Oklahoma, here's what's happened. Closer look. You can see they climbed. They're over 1,200 for a couple years there. 2004, they went down to 812. Closer look of why. In April of 2004, they passed legislation nearly identical to what is proposed here today by Representative Johnson. And a little bit of a closer look at Oklahoma. For a two-year period, 2003 and 2004, here are the meth lab seizures by month. The black bars are the 2003. You can see January through December, up and down a little bit, but still pretty high, over 80, sometimes over 100. The white bars are 2004. You can see January of 2004, it went from, comparing January to January, from about 105 to 121. Then, there's where the law is passed, in April 2004. And you can see what happens to the white bar graphs after that. First month is down 39%, 45%. You get all the way over to where you're comparing December of 2003 to December of 2004. It's down, that's the 80% that you also often hear thrown around in the media. Oklahoma, December to December, after this law has been in effect for 6-7 months, they're down 78% in the labs. January, it's even a more drastic figure again. They're continuing to drop because of the law. I would tell you that in my opinion, and I've talked to the people in Missouri and Oklahoma, Oklahoma feels safer today. Their children, their environment, their innocent people, everybody's safer today because of this. In Missouri, they're less safe. They are going across the border, and that's part of the reason why Missouri and in turn Iowa is next. Their labs, I would predict, unless they get as serious about it as Oklahoma did, those labs will continue to climb. Just a very quick sampling of some of the, I mentioned the violence in Minnesota associated with meth. These, I'll just give you a real quick sampling of a handful of cases or a few more. In Minnesota, most of these are the last couple of years. I think a number of them you'll recognize. Some of them go back 4 or 5 years. In Dilworth, it was a drug deal that simply went bad. They put the guy in the trunk, drove him around, beat him, and they were going to take him and dump him in the woods up in Little Dilworth outside of town. One of the meth dealers took a hatchet and buried in his head. In Fountain, a guy was running a meth lab, house started on fire, he burned to death. Long Prairie, Minneapolis, I would think everybody would remember this one. Minneapolis, it was Carpenter and Earl were the two criminals, meth users, meth addicts. They broke into a home in Minneapolis. Or actually, one of them did, murdered a father and his handicapped daughter. Less than a week later, they went to Long Prairie, Minnesota. Absolute, total, complete randomness. Picked a home, knew nothing about the people in the home. Mom's sleeping on the couch. She has two teenage kids in their beds. It's like 2 in the morning. They go in, and it's an understatement to say they simply murdered him. They tortured him. They forced family members to see and hear what was going on to other family members before they died. This is one of the most horrendous crimes I've ever imagined. Pillager was a triple homicide. It's a lab or a meth dealers in a trailer in a rural park just outside Brainerd. I happened to be in Bemidji working that day, and on the way back I stopped there. Our crime scene team was there. I went through that crime scene. These were three people in about their 20s, all three of them shot in the head, dead. Before being murdered, in particular the woman, I've analyzed the crime scene. I've looked at our lab reports. I know what she went through before dying. She was tortured to no end. I can't imagine ending your life that way. The people involved in this, in the trailer, and the people who committed the crime involved in meth distribution and meth use, the main criminal in this ended up committing suicide out in Vegas as we were about to arrest him. Elizabeth, it was a meth lab in a home. The mother was a user. She was left her children home alone. There ended up being a fire in the home, and both children died. Grove City, a simple search warrant, meth-related. Deputies went up, knocked on the door, started going in. Guy reached for a gun. Fight took place. No one was injured, but he ended up being charged with attempted first-degree murder of a police officer. A short while later, the defendant in that case committed suicide. He's a meth user. Gilbert, small town. You probably remember this one from this summer. It was in August. 3 or 4 bars in this town, I think. It's a nice little town up on the Iron Range. Couple of dealers see a guy who owes them money come out of a bar at midnight. They grab him, they beat him. It's witness abduction. They drive them around. It's August. It's 87 degrees. They duct tape them, put them in the trunk. When they finally take him out and dump him in the woods, we find him at 6 o'clock that night. He's got 10 bullet holes in his head. Hancock and Morris started with a meth investigation in Minneapolis, took him to a lab out in rural Minnesota. When they went up to the lab, the cook, who's high on meth, comes out with a shotgun, starts shooting at the SWAT team, and they shoot and kill him. I could go on all day, and I know you don't want me to, Mr. Chair, but there are my point is that these violent crimes, terrifically violent crimes the last few years, are fueled by methamphetamine. I talked to our agent in Marshall this morning and asked him, can you give me a couple of examples of cases in the last 5 years you've worked homicides that are meth-related? He said, I could give you two or three that weren't. And he's worked dozens and dozens of homicides down there. We have cases in the cities. Burnsville, a 16-year-old girl was raped and then she died of a meth overdose that night. 12 and 14-year-olds were raped by a meth dealer in Eagan. One of the real, I mean, there's tragedies. Suicides are terrible in this epidemic. In Arrowhead, Minnesota, small town, mother shoots her son in the chest, 3-year-old son shoots him in the head, then shoots herself in the head. As I said, there's a whole slew of those. I think you will hear, in fact, I'm very confident you will hear that there's an argument that the harm caused here is not significant enough to outweigh the inconvenience to the private sector and to citizens and to customers who need to buy pseudoephedrine. I don't believe in that argument. I think that public safety and certainly private sector convenience, customer convenience, is weighed all the time. That's part of what the legislature does, I guess. I stopped at 4 red lights on the way here. It took me 30 to 40 seconds at each one, probably. That's an inconvenience. That took time away from my life. Why did I do that? Because public safety. We don't want people dying at intersections. We went to the University of Northern Iowa, went to customers, and asked them, did a scientific study on what would they say about this. They explained the meth issue. If you were to buy the medications they refer to here, the quantity of medications are the pseudoephedrine medications that contain pseudo. Here were the results of that study about a year ago. 66% said that it would not be much of an inconvenience to limit the quantity that they could buy. Okay, they didn't see 66% said no inconvenience, 19% said small inconvenience, so 85% basically favored the limitations. How much of an inconvenience to you if people had to show a photo ID to buy it? Again, the no inconvenience, the small inconvenience added up to 83%. How much of an inconvenience would it be to ask a pharmacist or a clerk? So in other words, put it behind the counter where you had to go to a pharmacist and ask them. You couldn't just buy it off the shelf. 59% no inconvenience, 16% small for 75%. The one study that you'll see on the tape, the one poll that WCCO did that you'll see next week, at the end of their segment on meth, they had viewers call in. 93% said they would favor putting the restrictions in this bill, the specific things. The limits on quantities, the photo ID, the pharmacist, and the signing of a log. 93% they favored that. Last slide to show you. It's another before and after. Something's going to happen here in Minnesota in the next 3 years. I hope that I'm not back in another 3 or 4 years to testify again. If as a parent, I guess, of children school age who bring home colds all the time, I bought pseudoephedrine last week, as a matter of fact. As a parent who will stay in motel rooms, who eat walleye out of our lakes, we've had ice fish houses where they're dumping the toxic waste in there, it breathes our air. As a cop who's concerned for all of our children in the state, who's concerned for impressionable teenagers like those here today, who maybe don't have the judgment to stay away from this the way they should, who are becoming addicts. As a cop who's met with sexual assault victims who were assaulted by meth users. And as a cop who's been to a number of these violent crime scenes, and as somebody who I think is fairly well informed of the cost benefits of the restrictions in this bill, I would ask you to inconvenience me. I'm willing to give up the equivalent of stopping at 3 or 4 more red lights a year to prevent this from happening. This is a very comprehensive bill, and I think if 3 years from now we want to prevent something like this from happening, the time is now to take action. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Johnson,
go ahead.
Can we turn the video off?
Mm-hmm.
Should I try to do it?
Mr. Chair, and we are ready to move on with more testifiers, if that's what you'd like to do.
All right. Representative Johnson, we have a list of a number that you provided us. I understand you want one taken out of order. Otherwise, we're going to go in order of this list. So the next, then, would be testimony by Paul Wilson, Chair, Olmsted County Commission. You'd step forward. Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Mr. Wilson, have a seat, and due to the fact that there's roughly 10 other people behind you, you will have 5 minutes. Please proceed.
Thank you, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak early. I have another commitment. First of all, I'm going to read for you a scenario, being your video didn't work, but I'd like to read for you a scenario of what happens in a local meth, or a portrait of a local meth case when one comes forward. First of all, corrections gets a tip from Narcotics Task Force that one of our female probationers is using and selling meth. Female probationer is on probation for DUI. Second, police and probation go to the home of the probationer to conduct a search. The first three people they encounter in the home do not live there. They are stoned and in their late teens and early 20s. The husband of the probationer comes out of the bedroom. He has sores all over from meth use. Meth found in the bedroom and appears to be a highly addictive crystal meth version. Marijuana and drug paraphernalia found under the couch in the living room. While at the home, an older daughter comes home. She is concerned about the situation and about her 11-year-old brother who was at school. Mom, who is the probationer, arrives in a car with another young person. Mom tries to deny her identity of the young person. The older daughter helps confirm her identity. The young person in the car with the probationer is the daughter of a law enforcement official from another jurisdiction. She claims she does not use. Meth is found in the vehicle and appears to be more crystal meth. The older daughter agrees to pick up brother and care for him. Dad goes to jail. Mom tests positive for meth and cocaine. Mom goes to jail. We'd like to think this is the end of the story, but unfortunately it's only the beginning. It's not even the first chapter. And as you can see, there's going to be many entangling engagements as the story goes forward. I'd like to share with you just very briefly two things. One, as you may, many of you may realize, Olmsted County was instrumental in passing the first clandestine lab cleanup for methamphetamine. It has happened about 3 years ago. Since that time, there's been numerous other counties around the state that have moved forward on adopting their own ordinances. I think several things came out of this that told us very quickly how we needed to proactively and very quickly move forward on this issue because we could see what was coming before us. We identified what the roles of various agencies within the county were, who was going to respond to what, those things were laid out. People were able to find out whether or not there had been a meth lab in that previous apartment that they might have been looking at, or perhaps a home that they were buying, significant issues for many of these areas that were not at this time identified. We have, over this period of time, identified approximately 30 to 31 labs. Most of them have been cleaned up. I think 23 or 24 have been cleaned up or taken care of at this time. Interestingly, when I looked at two complete years, 2003 and 2004, in the year 2003, there were approximately 18 identified situations, 17 which were taken care of that year. In the year 2004, there were 8 that were identified. 2 have been cleaned up as of this report. There are still 6 pending. But what it tells me is the very quick action taken by local government to begin to address this issue is very important and very instrumental. I think that could, hopefully that will be the trend that will continue in the future, but we don't know yet. And that's why I want to invite. This is part of a continuum of what I think needs to be done. The other area I want to talk about just very briefly, and I'll try to be as briefly as I can, is on a treatment issue and in a way that we have developed in Olmsted County of addressing this issue, certainly more in the perspective of our those who have been arrested and convicted and are placed in our ADC. And this is a collaborative approach, and I know the government, state government, is looking for local governments to collaborate wherever they can. We have done so successfully, not just within counties, although we have the Dodge Filmer in Olmsted County that is part of this. Also, the Olmsted County Adult Detention Center and Olmsted County Social Services, because as I, when I read you that scenario, it touches every facet and every area of certainly county government and certainly state government. There's no question about that. When I looked at a few estimated costs, what does this cost? When we heard the previous speaker talk about this from the statewide, I happened to pick up one county's expense that was estimated very accurately, I think, over the last year, Crow Wing County, a little over $1.8 million was a tax levy was estimated spent to deal with this issue, which comes down to about $33.50 per citizen. If that were the case in Olmsted County, you can do the math with 130,000 population approximately. Now, I realize there will be variances from county to county, but I think they're going to be pretty close to accurate. That's a pretty significant issue that the taxpayers are going to have to deal with. Someone touched on Kanabec County. I know that over 10% of their levy of $6.7 million was basically used to address this issue. So it is significant. Back to the collaborative effort that we have going on. This is part of the continuum. I realize there's no one silver bullet that's going to resolve this issue. But there's great risk by not dealing with this with public or with offenders. Public safety, violence, other crime that can come out of this if folks are not dealt with. The high cost of law enforcement, investigation, prosecution, detox, and other medical issues, including medical and dental care, are very significant. Research from the Matrix Institute, and I'll just very briefly tell you, the Matrix Institute is an institute in California that has monitored for 20 years the activities of what methamphetamine has done in that state and what are some of the possibilities to help lessen those impacts, has really developed the fact that best guidelines and best practices need to be developed within our institutions to deal with offenders. And they have monitored this over a long period of time. Obviously, they got into the game earlier. This started on the West Coast in the rural areas and migrated rather quickly to the urban areas. And obviously, I think it will be a similar pattern that will happen here.
Mr. Wilson, could you proceed to conclude, please?
I certainly will. Very quickly. I'll talk very quickly. The Crossroads and Odyssey program is what we have developed in our county. It has, to date, we've had about 18 people that have involved in one part of the program, that's the latter part, and then also in the former part. But bottom line is, for over a year's period, people are monitored on this program, worked with intensively, and I'll give you the cost. Working with both programs is approximately $6,500 per participant. This compares with a $22,000 cost for 1 year of imprisonment. A first offense sentence for manufacturing methamphetamine is 86 months. Or at a cost of about $110,000, not including dental and medical care. I would be happy to get information for this group if you would like this, so that each of you can have a copy of it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Wilson. Next, we have John Stewart, State Public Defender. Mr. Stewart, have a seat, and 5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. I realize it's not every day that you see a public defender here supporting a new crime provision. But I'm here because the State Board of Public Defense strongly supports the efforts in Article 1 of this bill to control ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, especially the aspects that would require people to show a photo ID and to log their purchases. We think that that would stop a lot of people from taking the first step of getting into producing methamphetamine. Public defenders see methamphetamine at its worst as it shows itself in the lives of our clients. We see the physical devastation firsthand. We see mental problems that really verge on the late stage of a psychosis in dealing with our clients. And we see our clients lose their liberty. We see our clients lose their futures. We see our clients lose their children because of methamphetamine. In talking with Deputy Superintendent O'Malley, I've learned that it takes approximately 1,000 pseudoephedrine tablets to make an ounce of meth. We would support you in controlling those tablets so that that ounce of meth never gets made, so that our clients don't have to suffer the kind of deterioration and pain and misery that were depicted in the photographs that you just saw on the screen. So that would conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair
and
members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. And the next testifier will be Sheriff Steve Schultz from Kanabe County. While you're having a seat, I'll just take a moment. It's our custom when we have a tour group in, especially students, to just take a moment to recognize them, thank them for taking their time and to share with us. And we have with us today a group of juniors from Bethany Academy in Bloomington, Minnesota. So welcome to the juniors from Bethany Academy. Deputy, I may have misidentified you. Give us your name and then go ahead. And I'd like you to keep your remarks about 5 minutes, please.
Sergeant Steve Johnson, with Anoka County Sheriff's Office. I supervise the crime lab. I apologize if I'm a little ill-prepared. However, it was a spur-of-the-moment request, and because I feel it's a very important issue, I'm here and quite willing to contribute in any way I can. I'm going to provide you with a kind of a grassroots frontline perspective. In 1998, first of all, the crime lab involves four deputies and myself as a sergeant supervising the unit. It began in 1998. We started to get our first meth lab calls. At that point, we weren't sure what they all entailed, what the dangers were. We've come a long ways since 1998 to the present. Four of us now have been DEA Clan Lab certified, which is, we've heard Mr. O'Malley talk about the DEA and OSHA regulations surrounding that certification. Just to throw out some numbers for you, since we've been processing meth labs, we've processed, and I've been involved with approximately 177 meth lab takedowns in the last 7 years. Meth labs are very involved. It's not just, in my opinion, another, quote, drug problem. It's far-reaching. It involves all kinds of elements of society and entities within the public service realm. What I see when I'm out in the field taking one of these things down is a significant drain on public safety resources. I see police involvement, and typically a meth lab takes us an entire shift, which may be anywhere from 8 to 10 hours, tying up at least two of us who are certified because of OSHA regulations involving a buddy system when you take these types of labs down. There's fire personnel involved because of the dangers of the chemicals. Should there be a fire or explosion, we need those people on hand. There's ambulance and first responder considerations. We need to typically pull out ambulance out of the line of service in the community and have them in a standby mode while we perform a takedown of a meth lab. And there's chemical assessment team considerations, which are a contingency of the fire departments. They have specialized training in air monitoring, environmental concerns regarding the meth lab itself from a safety standpoint. We need to know what those air qualities are and keep constant monitoring of those qualities when we're there working in that environment. Child protection, service issues, social services oftentimes get involved. We've heard figures, I believe Mr. O'Malley indicated 50%. That's not unrealistic from what I've seen in the number of meth labs where children have been present. It's very significant. And again, the elements of danger. The chemicals used are hazardous by themselves, let alone when they're used in combination with other chemicals. You've got acids and bases, which are highly corrosive. You've got petroleum solvents, which are off-gassing, poorly contained in a closed environment. You've got flammable issues with explosion and fire, and a whole host of other concerns. You've got weapons involved. You've got closed-circuit TV, cameras. They're cooking inside. They're watching you come up the driveway. We rely on an element of surprise as far as a safety thing here. If we can go in and effectively take down the lab, that's a big component. But if they know we're coming, guns are in close proximity. It's not unusual to seize weapons at the scene of a meth lab for forfeiture purposes later on.
Sergeant, if you could proceed to conclude, I would appreciate
it. Yes, I will.
Thank you.
I've been in at least five house fires involving meth labs. I've seen children infested with head lice, little or no food in the refrigerators. We've had meth labs in motels, motor vehicles. They can be anywhere. Dumping of chemical waste, burn pits out in the back. We've had, and I'll conclude here, Mr. Jason Creed, you have probably seen that on the news in Ramsey, the random shooter, shooting individuals as they're performing or going about their daily business in homes associated with meth. It's a far-reaching problem. It affects most everybody concerned, so I hope you give it some serious thought here.
Sergeant, thank you for your time
and
coming today to be with us. The next, I'm going to ask two county attorneys to come and join us. Amy Klobuchar, Hennepin County Attorney, and also James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. And since we're getting two for one, you can share the 5 minutes we're allotted.
All right.
See what you can do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Smith.
Would you pull your microphone
okay.
Just.
Thank you, Chairman Smith. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, along with County Attorney Jim Backstrom. Meth is truly a statewide problem, and it's an issue where Democrats, Republicans, Independents, as well as Metro and non-Metro Minnesota can join together in a common cause. In particular, I know Representative Johnson discussed the fact that much of the focus about methamphetamine has been about the rural areas. But in fact, as he mentioned, we're seeing more and more of it in the metropolitan area as well. Last year in Hennepin County, our meth cases increased more than 20% over 2003, even though our overall drug case loan remained steady. Meth cases now represent almost 15% of our total drug caseload in Hennepin County. Many of these cases are from the suburbs. In fact, at least a couple of times each month, we charge a number of young men, sometimes juveniles, with going into places like Walmart or Mills Fleet Farm or a Target or a Walgreens, attempting to buy mountains of cold medicine. Alert store personnel have usually notified the police and were able to make arrests and charge these men. But a lot of the defendants are usually from the surrounding counties and they're coming into Hennepin County to buy the Sudafed. A few years ago we had a guy who literally set a house on fire in Maple Grove when he tried to cook meth in his basement. But there's probably no better or more horrifying case than the one that Mr. O'Malley discussed earlier, and that is the over a 2 week span in April of 2003. First, 88-year-old William Schwartz and his mentally disabled daughter Claudia were killed in their northeast Minneapolis home. 13 days later, 120 miles away in Long Prairie, Minnesota, Holly Cromie and her two teenage children were killed in their home. They had been tied up, beaten with a hammer, and their throats were cut. The young teenage girl was raped before she was killed. Acting on a tip, the police were able to arrest Jonathan Carpenter and Christopher Earle. And I can tell you that I was in the Tide County courtroom when Jonathan Carpenter confessed to this crime and told his chilling tale of what he did. He seemed to remember every detail. And what was interesting about this case is that he really didn't have an extensive prior record before he committed these murders, at least not an extensive violent crime record. By his own admission in court, he said that he was a heavy meth user and he hadn't slept in days. When he entered the Schwartz home in Minneapolis with the intention of robbing it, he said he had been using crank earlier in the day. And when he entered the Cromie house, he said he was, in his own words, tweaking really bad off of the crank. We know what happened in this case. He pled guilty to the Long Prairie triple homicide, and several weeks later, he killed himself in prison. Just last week, I was in the Minneapolis courtroom with the case of Christopher Earle, where the Schwartz family had their one and only time to remember their loved ones in court and to face Christopher Earle for what he'd done. I told that family then about this hearing and about the fact that this bill is being considered by the legislature, and I told them that we hope that something good will come out of this case. Police and prosecutors statewide know that meth breeds a host of problems, violent crimes, robberies and thefts, child abuse and neglect, and even public health risks from the toxic chemicals used in making the drug. It's a danger to first responders, to police, and to firefighters who've shown up at the scene, a scene that is really the equivalent of a hazardous waste site. We hope that we will be able to get this bill passed. We see for a problem of this magnitude that a comprehensive approach is needed. Education and prevention is needed as our treatment efforts. But the key here is to try to stop this at its source, which this bill does, to try to stop the people who are trying to buy the ingredients from doing it. And I'll end with an example of a case that we had that was just recently charged, and this was five people who were caught at the Kmart on Lake Street in Minneapolis with seven packages of Sudafed. And one of the defendants said, and this is from the complaint, defendant Renda stated that Kittlesman and defendants Brown and McCarl traveled to Minnesota to purchase Sudafed-type drugs in mass quantities because it is too difficult to make such purchases in other states. I thought that was an appropriate end as you consider this bill, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time as well, Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, James Baxter, Dakota County Attorney and the current chair of the Urban County Attorneys Association. Like my colleague Amy Klobuchar, I have seen firsthand the devastation of meth in my community. Dakota County had over 30 meth labs seized last year by our law enforcement officers compared to 18 the year before and 10 in the year 2002. So you can see the rapidly increasing growth in my community. We've also had a disproportionate number of the meth arrests in our community compared to statewide statistics. So we've had over the last 2 years, we've had over 35% of the arrests for meth have been in Dakota County, Minnesota, one of our suburban communities, as you all well know. It's a huge concern in our state. It's something that we do need to take aggressive action to address. Like our public defender colleagues, Minnesota's county attorneys support placing restrictions on the sale of pseudoephedrine, removing that from our shelves, putting it behind the counter, requiring proof of age, and requiring limitations on the number of doses that should be purchased. We think this is wise legislation, important legislation, needed legislation for the public safety of our state and the protection of our citizens and our communities. I would also like to leave with the committee, just for your record, I know many of you maybe already have a copy of this, but the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has adopted a very comprehensive statement and policy positions concerning drug control and enforcement. I'd like to leave them for the record of this committee and have them distributed to your members. We believe that we need to have a comprehensive approach to dealing with drug crimes in our state, and the regulation and restrictions of that are contained within this bill to deal with one of our most rapidly rising problems, the methamphetamine problem, are sorely needed, and I commend the leadership of Representative Johnson and Senator Rosen for bringing this issue forward, and I thank all of you for your time and efforts.
Thank you for your time as well, Mr. Baxter, Ms. Klobuchar. Thank you. Is Judge Guerin in the audience? If not, then we'll move along to Nancy E. Christensen, Minnesota Grocers Association. Ask you to come forward and ask you to tell us what you can, and please limit yourself to 5 minutes, as everyone else has.
I've got some rep options here.
Mr. Chair, she has some material to pass out as well, right over here, once the page is done.
Page will get it, if you'd proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Christensen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grocers Association. And I'm here to testify to let you know that on behalf of our members and other retailers as well, we're acutely aware of the issues of methamphetamine in the communities that we serve. Last July, I sent our lobbyists to a conference in Washington, D.C. to find out a little bit more about meth. We were just beginning to hear about it then. And when she came home, she brought some materials that will be passed out to you shortly of a program called Meth Watch that had been
pioneered, I believe, is it in Kansas, and was proving to be effective in terms of community awareness and curtailing the problem of meth labs in Kansas. I showed this material to our board at a board of directors meeting in July, and they said, get this stuff and get it to us right away. We want to put it in our stores. It wasn't that easy to do because Kansas wasn't in a position to be able to deal with multiple requests on this. And the Consumer Healthcare Products Association decided to grant, give money to anyone in any state that was willing to implement this program. And I think 10 states have already applied for grants, and some of the grants are being made to associations and others, to people like us. The Minnesota Grocers Association has a foundation, and we teamed up with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association to apply for a grant. We got the grant probably just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we've already produced enough materials that you see in your packet to make over 7,000 packets of this material. We have people from Partnership Resources Incorporated. That's a partnership of those with disabilities who work in who work with their community, and they are in our offices as we speak packaging this material. In 2 weeks, we hope to be done and send this out to the retailers, our membership, the pharmacist membership, members of the retail merchants, and the Petroleum Marketers Association. So hopefully within the next 3 weeks or so, when you go into stores that sell pseudoephedrine, that you will see these materials. Our purpose in putting this in our store is threefold. Number one, we want to educate our associates about the dangers of methamphetamine and how common products are used to make the drugs. It's not only pseudoephedrine products, but also other kinds of things in our stores, from tinfoil to batteries. We want to educate our customers about the issue, and we want to enlist the help of both our associates and our customers to be aware of suspicious activity and to report it to the appropriate authorities. Most of the funds are going into these materials, but with the pharmacists, we're also setting up a website, www.minnesotamethwatch.com. That's minnesotamethwatch.com. And we also have a small amount of money to give to communities as grants for community education, and there will be a Meth Watch task force that will determine who gets these community grants. Again, we wanted to make you aware of the fact that the retailers are being very, very proactive in working with law enforcement and their communities to deal with this issue. We don't support the Schedule 5 as being the only way to deal with pseudoephedrine products getting into the hands, or inappropriately into the hands of meth cooks. We would like to work with legislators. We do support legislation to put single ingredients behind the counter and to limit the access to those products that are causing problems for you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I stand for any questions you may have.
We're going to move along. However, this item that says Meth Watch Program with a white thing on it, where does this go?
Those are shelf tags. And there's a training tape in the meth lab in your packets, and I think there's also... if you look on that poster, and also on, I think there's a brochure in there, it talks about other products that are used, commonly used by meth cooks to make this. And I know that we've had some retailers put lithium batteries already behind their counters because goes on the products that, all the pseudoephedrine products, yes.
So this sticks out this from the shelf.
This sticks out, yes.
And this labels the product you need to make meth.
No, it makes people aware. No, everybody, the people who know, people who know, people are making methamphetamine knows what to get. I mean, they don't need to have anyone point it out. I think the issue is to watch whether people are buying this or putting it in their baskets in inappropriate numbers, and also on other other kinds of products that may be used in this issue. Again, after we had heard from the retailers in Kansas on how successful they thought it was in raising community awareness and helping to curtail this problem in their state.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
We wanted to do something. Thank you.
Very good. We'll move along to Nicole Valentine, National Association of Chain Drug Stores.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nicole Valentine. I'm a regional state government affairs representative with the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. NACDS represents over 200 retail chain community pharmacy companies that operate about 35,000 community pharmacies around the country. In Minnesota, NACDS represents 24 member companies that operate over 580 pharmacies, employing more than 58,000 people. Our Minnesota members include Target, Snyder Drug, Walgreens, A-Strip Drug, Thrifty White, and Super Value. Although I represent a national organization, I am a Minnesotan. My home and office are both in Minneapolis. NACDS and its member companies have been working with legislators and law enforcement officials around the country on meaningful retail restrictions to impact the meth problem in states. Community retail pharmacies are responsible members of their communities and are prepared to support reasonable and proven methods to limit meth cook access to precursor chemicals. The majority of our members have imposed voluntary sales limitations on the number of packages that a customer can buy in one transaction. In addition, many of our member companies have already placed products most susceptible to theft behind a manned counter or in a locked case. NACDS and its member companies have serious concerns about legislative proposals that would make products containing ephedrine and pseudoephedrine Schedule 5 controlled substances. This approach, approved in only two states, Oklahoma and Oregon, is overly restrictive for retailers, uses pharmacists' time and skill inefficiently, and would be inconvenient for customers, and again, has not been proven effective over time. A primary concern among our membership about making cold and allergy medications controlled substances is the impact that this change would have on our pharmacies. As the population ages and more and improved prescription medications become available, more prescription medications must be stocked in pharmacies. Placing non-prescription medications behind the pharmacist's counter will put a strain on the space available in the pharmacy. Often a pharmacy is only 800 square feet of a store. A traditional pharmacy or a traditional drugstore like a Walgreens or a CVS has about 10,000 square feet of space. An average big box retailer like Walmart or Target carries about 200 different cold and allergy stock keeping units, or SKUs, which just means individual products, in their stores. This amounts to about 24 linear feet of shelf space. A member company that operates in Oklahoma, in order to comply with their law, reduced the number of SKUs it carries by over 60%, so that the product could fit in the 3 linear feet of shelf space available behind the pharmacist's counter. So an unintended consequence regarding these proposals is to limit customer choice when it comes to these safe and legal products. Another key concern among our membership is the impact that these Schedule 5 proposals would have on our pharmacists. Pharmacists are highly educated healthcare providers, best utilize counseling patients on the use of prescription medications and possible drug interactions. Pharmacists attend 4-year post-college pharmacy schools, and in most cases, this is followed by a year-long residency program. Pharmacists must be utilized and compensated appropriately for their skills, knowledge, and education. Heavy workloads demand efficiency from our pharmacists and our pharmacy staff each day. It is counterintuitive then to mandate that pharmacists interact with each cold and allergy sufferer. NACDS data from 2003 shows that the average cost for a pharmacy to dispense a prescription in Minnesota was $7.38. The added responsibilities that would be placed on pharmacists under a Schedule 5 proposal would not be compensated.
Ms. Ballantyne, if you could proceed to conclude.
Sure. In addition, several of these proposals being discussed would require that pharmacists log each of the precursor transactions. This would be extremely time-consuming for pharmacists to collect this individually identifiable information. And we have several concerns about the liabilities that could be placed on pharmacies and pharmacists when it comes to logging. For example, what liability does the pharmacy or the pharmacist in charge face if a customer exceeds his or her monthly allowance of products? What responsibility does the pharmacy have for checking a log with hundreds of entries for a duplicated name? And what expectation would be placed on chain pharmacies to know which customer has been to one of its other locations to purchase products? I know there's been some talk about the state creating a centralized place to collect this information, and that would help to alleviate some of our concerns, but realistically, DHS is in no position to do that anytime in the near future, as far as we can tell. At this time, they don't collect information on controlled substance prescriptions. So with that, I'll just end, and thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your time as well. Next is Sharon Johnson, Wayside House Incorporated. You come forward, and I'd ask you to take the table and give us your name, and please limit yourself to 5 minutes like the previous testifier.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Johnson. I'm the executive director of Wayside House, and I'm also a member of MARCH, which is the State Association of Treatment Providers. Wayside House is a women's residential treatment program located in St. Louis Park. We also operate a residential house for women who have been separated from their children because they've been caught up in child protection, and provide supervised reunification while those moms who have been completing treatment come back with their kids. As you can guess, we've seen a marked increase in the number of meth addicts entering our treatment program. Since last August, we have continuously been running a waiting list that's at least a month out or more, and this probably discounts the actual number of women who've sought treatment at our center, as they either find someplace else or unfortunately disappear back into their addiction. As you can imagine, when somebody wants to enter treatment, we prefer to have them be able to come in that day or the next day, as opposed to saying in about a month we can accommodate you. Women disproportionately choose meth. And we see young women from both the Southern County metro area and throughout the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, meth is known for its side effects of creating a lot of high energy and weight loss, and so particularly young women are attracted to those qualities. I'm concerned about the capacity of the treatment center to meet these new demands. I don't know what the statewide trends are, but I do know that anecdotally a lot of my colleagues also report running significant waiting lists at this point in time. Clients who come to us, as I'm sure you know from previous testimony, are likely to have significant medical issues. We also have very young women, 19, 20, and 21, who are facing 7 years in prison. They have been caught up in very significant sentences because of their involvement with a boyfriend who is involved in manufacture or distribution. And we look at providing treatment to these young women who made very poor choices, frankly being clueless about the long-term consequences for them and for their children. And I'm not sure that these have acted yet as a deterrent for these choices. I think it's very important to stress that we have a very good treatment provider network in Minnesota, and that we all have been having experience in treating meth addiction. At our center, meth addicts complete treatment at the same rate as those who enter for other addictions, whether it's other drugs or alcohol. For us, for our initial 21-day program, that's about 84%. And for women who stay on longer to complete an additional 75 days of halfway programming, that's about 60%. And completion rate is a fairly good indicator of likelihood to maintain sobriety, although we certainly need more data over long time when it comes to meth. One of the things that is very fortunate for us is that we do have this flexible length of time. My counselors report that meth addicts, unlike other addicts, can take 2 or 3 weeks before they're cognitively clear enough to have meaningful participation in treatment. Oftentimes the first week is just needed to simply sleep and be safe and be oriented to where they are. So if I were running just a 21-day treatment program, we'd be discharging people just about the time that cognitively they might be ready to start really learning something and participate and starting to make decisions. So we know that how we structure treatment may need to change. Length of time in treatment may need to change. I've heard some real misinformation repeated that meth can't be treated. That has not been our experience. I don't mean to diminish that this is a very significant and very nasty drug, as you have heard. However, we are painfully gaining lots of experience in how to work with meth addicts. So I hope that you will look closely at working with DHS staff, drawing on the capacities and the expertise of those who are already in the system. I know that there have been some dollars allocated for some pilot programs. I would just hope we would not gear something up with the required infrastructure that would last only on a short-term basis, while we in the treatment center network are facing what we know will be a long-term problem. Thank you very much for your commitment to this area, and thank you for considering treatment as part of the multi-pronged approach we need to take to address this issue.
Ms. Johnson, thank you for your time. Our final testifier will be Judy Cook, Consumer Healthcare Products Association. Have a seat, and please take no more than 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Judy Cook with Cook Hill Gerard Associates, representing the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, a national trade association representing the companies who manufacture over-the-counter drugs. I have the unenviable task of asking you to rethink the approach that you are taking on precursor drugs in this legislation. At the outset, I want to thank Representative Johnson for talking with us, and hopefully we can continue our conversation. CHPA wants to work with all of you in your efforts to pass reasonable, effective, and comprehensive approach to stemming methamphetamine production and abuse. And we are pleased to be a partner by having provided the $100,000 grant for the Meth Watch program. We realize that it is not the answer, but it will play an important role. We recognize that methamphetamine abuse is a serious law enforcement and public health problem that affects the entire communities. And I think it's been said before, but the DEA has said that about 80% of the meth comes from super labs, mostly in Mexico. 20% is produced in small toxic labs across the country. These labs generally yield enough meth for an individual's use, but they do create costly environmental and human impact that can be devastating. Pseudoephedrine is a safe and effective decongestant found in many over-the-counter cough, cold, allergy medications, and unfortunately is a primary ingredient in methamphetamine. We believe that the state legislatures, like you, should balance the need to restrict access to meth precursor chemicals and balance it with the family's caregiver needs to purchase cost-effective OTC cold and allergy medicines. This legislation mirrors an Oklahoma law which puts pseudoephedrine products on Schedule 5 of the Controlled Substances Act. And while the preliminary data indicates that the number of meth labs is down in Oklahoma, the DEA has stated and testified before Congress that they suggest collecting more data before making any conclusions about the success of the Oklahoma law. It is also important to note that there are other law enforcement provisions in the Oklahoma law that might be contributing to the reduction in meth labs. A key component of the new Oklahoma law that is not constitutional here prevents bail for individuals found apprehended for meth. And law enforcement says that generally what happens is if you let them out, they cook meth again. Well, if they're not out on the streets, they're not cooking meth. And there are a lot of people who suggest that that may have been a pretty key component to the reduction in the meth labs, not just their approach to precursor drugs. It's also important to note that Oklahoma's approach is not the only success story in reducing meth labs. Other states have taken less restrictive measures and have had success. California and Washington have taken less restrictive measures, and according to the DEA, California meth labs declined by 27% in 2003, and preliminary data for 2004 shows that the number declined by another 50%. Washington State reported meth lab reductions of 27% from 2002 to 2003. 2004 saw another decline in the labs by an additional 34%. A number of other states, you might like to know, have recently considered Schedule 5 and are looking at other approaches instead. Illinois, Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, and even Iowa, which people have referenced in the past, their state senate last week passed a Schedule 5 bill, but with significant modifications to allow any retailer to sell a limited amount of pseudoephedrine product. So I think that other legislatures are looking at the Schedule 5 issue and really taking into account the need to find balance. The other thing is that with 80% of the meth coming from super labs or imported in bulk form, meth is cheap and readily available on the streets. We are now learning of a more potent form of meth called glass, that apparently is only made in Mexican super labs. And there was an article in the Red Wing paper on Tuesday, and it said that home labs produce, like, just grams of meth, but Mexican super labs produce as much as 100 pounds of glass in a matter of days. Wisconsin narcotics officers quoted an article saying, "Even the headway that's been made in Wisconsin and Minnesota to make Sudafed a behind-the-counter drug may be futile. Due to the volume of glass being trafficked from Mexican cartels, lawmakers won't even put a scratch in meth." This makes an important point. I know that we all are desperate to reduce meth in our communities, but it is important to draw the distinction between reducing meth use and reducing meth labs. We agree that appropriate controls on precursor drugs should reduce the incidence of meth labs. Absolutely something we need to do. But if it were only as easy to pass Schedule 5 and reduce meth. Early indications from Oklahoma are that reductions in meth labs do not correlate to reductions in meth use or availability. You're not the Crime Prevention Committee anymore, but as this committee, I ask you to consider one final thing.
We're either the judiciary policy and finance and policy and finance if you're living in the past, or crime prevention if you're really living in the past, or public safety if you're living in the present. But go ahead.
My apologies.
That's fine.
I guess I do live in the past sometimes. But the question is, do you really believe that our local retailers and pharmacists are the criminals in all this? Do you want to make them the criminals? Do we really want law enforcement to utilize their scarce resources going after retailers and pharmacists who have been given the impossible task of going through pages of a paper log to see if a customer is over their limit on pseudoephedrine products? We've heard that in Oklahoma, law enforcement did review the pharmacy's logs, and that pharmacy is actually threatened with losing its license to control to sell controlled substances. Is that really what we want here, or can we take a more reasonable approach? There is no quick fix to the meth problem. Legislators should pass comprehensive measures to provide for law enforcement, lab cleanup, demand reduction, education and treatment, and reasonable controls on precursor drugs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That's the end of the listed testimony for today. Members, just as a reminder for further clarification, next week, Tuesday, March 1st, and audience, please listen as well. Tuesday, March 1st, we will be taking up other meth-related bills that are before our committee. Wednesday, March 2nd, we will be taking up the amendments that are in our packet, Representative Paymar, Representative Soderstrom, and any other amendments that may come along. Thursday, March 3rd, we will be taking up other bills. So Tuesday of next week, meth-related bills, not this one. The following day, Wednesday, we'll be reviewing and acting upon amendments. That will give time there. And then Thursday, other bills. Now, having said that, the bill is back before us on the movie that we missed out on today will be on Tuesday. We could take time, if you choose, Representative Paymar and Soderstrom, to go through your amendments, but they are in the packet. You will have plenty of time next week or thereafter if needed. So if that's adequate, then the bill is back before us. Representative Johnson, if you renew your motion.
I do renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Just to clarify, that motion is Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 572, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Policy, and Finance. Not part of the motion, but with the understanding that we will see the bill roughly 4 weeks down the road.
That's correct.
Discussion at this time? If not, all those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.